I'm Mitch Albom of the Detroit Free Press.
I'm Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe and ESPN.
I'm Mike Lubega, and welcome to the Friday edition of the Sports Reporters Podcast, where we kind of put a bow around everything that's happened in the week so far before we then show up on Monday and put a bow around everything that happens in the weekend. Obviously, the main story in sports, other than, you know, a full round of preseason football last night, which we will get to in great depth, is the last major golf championship of the year, the PGA, being played at Belle Reve in St. Louis, which has had a couple of majors in the past 50 years, but now has produced, after just the first day, and again, people will hear this over the weekend, so this is going to be an extremely fluid situation, an extremely interesting leaderboard. But before we start, I want to ask Mitch and Bob, what you think about this being the last time, at least for now, that the PGA will be the last major of the year, because they are moving it to May next year, which means that the major season will begin at the Masters, end at the British Open, and basically land last from April to July and then be done. Bobby, what do you think about that?
Doesn't feel right to me at all when I first heard about it. I think the reason that that they are so spooked by the NFL is almost pretentious to think that that's really an issue for them. Right. I just think that they have their world, they have their fandom. It's not as if there's all this gigantic neutral sports fans out there that are you know, overlapping here. And I don't think that's the case at all. I think they don't recognize who they are. I think this is a disruption of the natural nature of the sport, and I think it's a mistake.
If that's the reason, that's really a mistake. I is that the stated reason, Bob?
No, yeah, that's from the NFL.
Yeah, right.
That August is too close to the NFL.
Well, look, we're going to be talking some football today.
Yeah, we're going to be talking some football that didn't dominate the weekend.
I'll let Mike elaborate, because this is his wheelhouse.
But, Mitch, I think there's something else at play here, and they don't want to say it. And I have seen this suggestion from golf people I like, including the great Dan Jenkins, who's the greatest golf writer ever lived. They're also continuing to try to pump up this, and I know a lot of money's at stake, this FedEx playoff season that comes after the major championship season. And Mitch, they're really trying to make like September now be like a major season all itself, with the $10 million playoff and the tour championship at the end. And it is just manufactured drama. The one place where you don't have to manufacture drama, and look how much time we spend on this podcast around major championships, is the majors. And so I don't like it. They even tried, Mitch, a long time ago, they even moved the PGA to February one time. Jack Nicklaus won a PGA in Palm Beach in February. But again, so you start from the middle of April, May, June, July. They have a three-month major season now for the four major golf championships. Yeah. I don't like it.
It feels too condensed to me.
Yep.
There are, a lot of players who fall in a major or they see their game come apart, that they use the time in between to sort of regroup. And let's face it, from Tiger Woods on down, everybody's interested mostly in how they perform in majors. And giving golfers enough time to take a week off or take a tournament off or to work on their swing or go do something else is part of that process. I know that they, I'm actually reading while we're talking the PGA sort of explanation of it, and they bury the television thing down in like fourth or fifth of the reasons why. But they talk about, the August heat and how many southern venues they could play in that might be more appealing if they're playing in May as opposed to August. And I guess that's true. I mean, considering Tiger Woods had to change his shirt after the third hole yesterday because he was too soaked in sweat.
He wanted to change his whole golf bag after starting out bogey double.
He should have changed his pants and underwear, too. But, I do feel it's a little crunched. Now, I mean, I think fans are going to eventually get used to it and like it, because they do like their sports kind of in condensed times. It's football season. That's one of the problems with baseball. It goes on for so long that it sort of lifts and drops. But I think for the golfers, it's going to feel like a whirlwind, 3 months, and either you're having a good season or you're not.
And here's the thing on this one. So getting back to this one, it produced a wonderful first day scoreboard, a leaderboard, where by my count, within four shots of the lead, you had seven major champions in the mix. So it looks like the golf course may sort this out. And even Molinari showed up, and he's only four strokes off the lead. And it's, you know, it's sometimes unusual for a guy to follow up one this quickly.
That's right. While going the 31 on the back nine, Mike.
Ricky Fowler played great yesterday. Zach Johnson played great. Dustin Johnson, all Johnsons played great. Justin Rose with a bad back play gate. My pick was Zach Lupica. We always have a little bet. It was Jason Dye, who is only three shots off the lead and is due to do something again. So it was extremely entertaining. Didn't you guys think an extremely entertaining first day?
Yeah, no, it was. It was an extremely entertaining first day. And at these, you know, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but I'm going to, as long as the rest of the golf world sounds like a broken record. I can't wait to get these majors started to get Tiger Woods out of the way. I hate to say it, but somebody needs to counter this. Every single story is, and Tiger Woods did this, when you've got 47 other golfers between him and the top of the lead, and, you know, they mention that Ricky Fowler's up there, and then it's right to Tiger Woods, who came out of the gate and tripped again. So that's four majors all this year for the fact that he's played. And, you know, he has played, I think this is his 14th tournament. So he's healthy. You know, the thing that everybody has always fallen back on in Tiger Woods, well, just wait if he got healthy. Just wait if he could play a full season. Just wait if we could see Tiger Woods. Well, he's finishing the year. There were no hitches in his back. There was no grabbing his knee. There was no falling to the ground. And then, is he going to be ready for this major? He was ready for all four majors. He played tournaments in between. He played some good golf. He played some very good golf. And he played some awful golf. And he hasn't won. And, of course, we were talking about this when he made a good showing at the British. He was a 12-1 co-favorite to win the PGA immediately. And so all the attention once again goes to him, and it takes away from Mike, as you mentioned, all these other golfers who are doing well. Now, to me, a far bigger story than Tiger Woods, will he ever get back, and is he ever going to, until he does it, is Ricky Fowler.
Yep.
Because he's been great for a really long time.
And he's popular, been close, Mitch. He's popular, so popular.
He's about to leave his 20s without that one big major. And every time he takes on one of these, to me, it's a lot more realistic to say, is this going to be the one for him, than it is to say, is this going to be the one for Tiger Woods?
Bob, to me, it has been fascinating. People just like Ricky Fowler, and I'm not saying he would be the most popular champion here. With the greater populace, it would be Tiger Woods. And Mitch, I tweeted this out last night. It's so great to get moment to moment coverage of a 42-year-old golfer who hasn't won a major since a few months before Barack Obama was elected president for the first time. Yeah. Okay. And this leaderboard is littered with great stories, but Bobby, Ricky Fowler would be an immensely popular champ.
You know, he supposedly is the millennial's choice, and, you know, he's got the identity with the hat and the colors.
And the commercials.
And he gives good commercial, no question. He's a kind of an Agassi-like figure in golf, if you will. He's knocked on that door, and he performs well in majors. He's top fives, top tens. Yes, he's in the time, and as I'm glad Mitch pointed out, he's about to turn 30. And he's not the kid anymore. He is an interesting figure.
And Rory McIlroy, to me, continues to be a fascinating study. I believe that the two guys out there, Mitch, I believe the two guys out there, just from my life of watching golf and looking at it right now, the two most talented players on the board are Rory McIlroy and Dustin Johnson. When they're playing well, and they hit it so far. They have so much game. But McIlroy hasn't won a major in 4 years. And my son was saying to me yesterday, he said, Dad, you look at Dustin Johnson when he's playing well. Isn't it amazing that he's only won one major so far? Mm. So, again, there are so many dramas on that board apart from, what's his name, the guy with the 14.
Let's mention someone. I'm going to jump up my hand, hold my hand. Mention who's leading, only because You know, and then it's kind of a local story. It's kind of nice and quaint. But this is a guy that, if you follow the golfing stats and all, you know, this is a guy who's known for one thing. He hits the crap out of it. He is a bombaroon.
And he's so talented. He's really talented and a great athlete, too.
All right. But he's known for his long distance, for his driving, and known to casual or you know, people say such an, I don't know if I'm casual, but the level of fandom that I occupy, I know him only for that. And the idea of him actually contending in a major, which he doesn't do often, am I right? Is interesting.
No, he doesn't do often. He's won on the tour, but he disappears in majors. He does not have a strong record, which would only make it that much more fascinating of a story. You know, he did lead for the day against, as Mike pointed out, a pretty damn talented leaderboard, and he was sitting at the -6 when he went out early this morning. And I think he'd be a great story. I think any of them would be good stories. And it really speaks to the fact of how many golfers in their 20s are really dominating here and have the right to expect that the attention falls on them and not on, you know, is this Tiger Woods' opportunity again? And I wish Tiger Woods no harm at all. Don't get me wrong. Despite all that he's done, he's maybe the greatest golfer, certainly one of the greatest golfer I've seen in my lifetime to watch every one of his tournaments. But if you're out of it, you're out of it. And sometimes I wish that if he's going to start this way and he's going to end up finishing sixth or tenth, that he would just miss the cut so that people could focus again on and that's part of these super groups that they're forming here. I have to say that if you get paired up with Tiger Woods in their attempt to create the NBA's, you know, the golf's version of an NBA super team to walk around at these majors for the first 2 days, you really are being handed a little bit of an extra burden of the crowds that come through there and the nuttiness and all the people that follow him. So I'd much rather focus on a Ricky Fowler story or on a McIlroy or a Spieth or even Tommy Fleetwood, who needs to change his last name clearly so that his checks don't get sent to somebody else. Because I not that this has anything to do with this, but you did see that story. It's one of the great honesty plays of all time. He was owed $154,000 for the British Open, his performance there, which he didn't win, but he did very well, and they sent it to some other Tommy Fleetwood, who used to be a golfer, and they put it in his bank account. Oh. And I didn't know that that's how you got paid, but they like direct deposited $154,000 in the wrong Tommy Fleetwood's bank account. And this Tommy Fleetwood, who did not play in the British Open and hasn't played in years, it was honest enough to say, I think that, like, you meant a different Tommy Fleetwood. Maybe you want to take back the $154,000.
That
even that's a story that I'd like to see, you know, anything, but will Tiger win it?
Mitch and Bob, I'm looking at the headline on one of the golf headlines on SI.com. This is the headline. As bounce back 70 at PGA shows, Tiger Woods refuses to fade away. All the things he says, oh man, I grinded out there. Everybody's grinding out there. Right. You think you're the only grinder? You think you're the only guy who got off to a slow start yesterday? Everybody's grinding. And he makes it sound like a sacrament. And Bob, you know, I know you've already said that he's had this dog ate my homework quality to him, even when he was on top. Yep. He's talking about the greens again and how they're bumpy. Yeah, they're bumpy for everybody. They're going to get bumpier all weekend long. It's quite extraordinary. There are certain parts, Mitch and Bob, there are certain parts of this story that you could just run on a continuous loop.
Yeah, and we do. And they do. And nobody seems, except in these podcasts, you know, which has become a regular theme, seems to feel bad about it. It's like, well, this is what the people want. Yeah. I'm not sure that that's the case at all. I think it's just you keep feeding it to them. So
that's what they believe. And it shows no sign of abating. No.
But the stakes for Dustin Johnson here, to me, are really big. Okay, he wants to win a major this year. Rory wants to win another major. Jordan Spieth, who has had a really sketchy year, is still young, looking to complete the career Grand Slam. Again, Justin Rose has showed himself, even though he's clearly impaired with a bad back, he's going to be around at major championships. So he's always somebody to watch. Jason Day was number one in the world, and I forget, Bob, what did he win, like seven tournaments in 11? It's like something crazy for a while. And he's trying to get back there. And again, in the context of Tiger, because apparently it's a rule they passed, so we have to filter this all through them. This field of young guys is so much deeper and better than it was when he first came along. That's just a fact. When Mitch, you were talking about it the other day, 145-year-old guy, Justin, 145-pound guy like Justin Thomas can hit the ball 350 yards off the tee. Okay. And that, by the way, guys, as an aside, it always makes me laugh that they had to take away anchored putters, but they will do nothing to scale back the golf clubs or the golf balls. But well, all these guys just keep coming over the hill at Tiger Woods.
And not only those guys coming over the hill who justifiably deserve the attention that we're paying to them because they're fantastic golfers, but let's look at 2018. Patrick Reed won the Masters. Yep. Brooks Koepka won the U.S. Open, and Francesco Molinari won the British Open. None of the names that we're talking about. That's how good the field is. Those guys are playing fantastic golf. Those guys are winning other tournaments. And yet, when it comes to the majors, there are still that many other talented golfers out there in the sort of second wave of the hill who can jump up and bite you and steal a major. And so we're still looking for a superstar, if you will, to win one of the majors this year. And that is, let's be honest, that's why Tiger Woods still commands all the things that he does, because he delivered in the big games. He didn't care about the tournaments in between, although he won plenty of those, but he delivered at the big moments, and there has not been any of the people. You know, Jordan Spieth showed it a little bit, obviously, in 2015. He won the Masters. He won the U.S. Open. He came close to the other ones. And we thought, okay, we've got our new Tiger Woods here. But he hasn't done it, but with the exception of the Open last year, the British Open, since then. And Rory McIlroy, for a flash, looked like he might do it. But none of these other guys is consistently knocking off the majors to take the mantle of Tiger Woods. And so in the American fascination of champions should win everything, LeBron should win every year, they hearken back to Tiger Woods when a major comes along, because they remember he was the one guy in golf who did it consistently for a stretch of time.
You know, and I'll say this, and you know, Bob has covered a lot of major golf championships, as have I, and you guys know I have not for any reason that I write about it a lot. You know, I've just been steeped in this sport for most of my life. You know, I came along with Nicklaus and Palmer and then Watson and Miller and all those guys. And I can remember going down to Congressional when the Open was held there 20 years ago, just because I wanted to see Tiger Woods play golf in person for the first time. And it was thrilling to watch the command he had of the golf ball, the distance, everything else. But Bob, I have to tell you, and I have nothing against this guy, and I love second act stories. I love comeback stories. His presence, even near the top of the leaderboard, does not enhance my interest in this sport any longer.
I don't know how I'm somewhere in the middle of all that, because if it's up there, I mean, I have to admit, watching the Open and when he took that lead, I said, oh my God.
Did you think he was going to win? I'm honest to God, Bob, did you think he was going to win?
No.
Because I never did.
All right. But I said, my God, this is, you know, all right. And then, of course, it took, what, 5 minutes for him to give it back, and that was that. But I'm still intrigued, but I don't know. See, I was saying during his, you know, darkest days, when he was absolutely out of him. He wasn't when 2 and 3 and 4 years ago, when we weren't sure what we were going to get out of him ever. I was saying, the tour, this is a good thing. Now we can wean ourselves off Tiger Woods, because as Mitch was just saying, we had all these guys that are coming along, and I was enough into the golf world in the decade preceding to know who a lot of these guys were. And I was excited. I said, we got a lot of good golfers. We don't need Tiger Woods anymore. But people get off, wean yourself away from Tiger Woods. I'm like, God, if you would have told me we'd be having a discussion such as this in 2018, I would have scoffed.
All right, Mitch, let me ask you this, because you, of the three of us, you are probably the most casual fan of golf. What, barring somebody like Molinari, you know, getting hit by lightning this week, what do you think would be the best story of a winner at the PGA, at this PGA?
Well, I think Fowler. Yeah. Honestly,
I agree.
I want to see him get in on his 29th year. I want to see him enter this conversation. I want to see him be able to go out to the next major and be expected to win instead of like, oh, he's gonna be another second place finisher. I think, you know, Spieth has been stamped and McIlroy has been stamped and Justin has been stamped and Dustin has been stamped. And I think Ricky Fowler needs a major to get over this thing. I think you turn 30 and all of a sudden the media starts coming after you. You know, you went through your 20s and you never, you know, that's when that's the most fertile period. It's almost like having kids, you know. It's a little late now, you know. That to me is the best thing that could come out of this year. In a year where no superstars won the previous three, although all three were great stories in their own right.
Yeah.
If Ricky Fowler got his major before his 30th with this last time we see a PGA in August, that to me would be the best story. And right now he's sitting pretty, but
I'm gonna make
three more rounds to go.
I'm going
to
make this unanimous on this panel, and I agree with that storyline. I'm going to throw you another name of a guy who I think is in danger through absolutely no fault of his own, and it is only that he has done well and has raised expectation and is now burdened with that, with the excessive expectation thing, that if he doesn't get a major in the next, I'll say, 2 years, he'll start to get the way people would be talking about him, the way they talked about Sergio all those years and how long it took Sergio to get one. All right, I'm talking about John Rahm. John Rahm has been burdened with the great expectations, and now he's not an American, so people don't care about him here in as way the way they would if he were an American. But I'm just going to throw it out there that John Rahm could be the next Sergio in terms of he should get one in the next couple of years, or else they'll put him in a category.
Ryan, he's 23 years old.
I'm just saying, Mike. He's already been around long enough to attract attention among. Maybe I'm crazy. I'm going to.
He doesn't turn Mr. Albert. He is an immensely gifted player who does not turn 24 until November.
Yeah. But he's been anointed as the next big thing, and therefore he's doing no fault of his own.
Well, pressure can start very young in sports, and witness that's a nice little pivot to the NFL, which began in earnest in terms of its preseason last night. And I have a cardinal rule that I make no judgments, no evaluations, or anything on preseason football in any way, shape, or form other than who got hurt. That's all I want to know in preseason football. Who got hurt? Because that's all it really portends for the regular season. I don't care if you go 4-0 in the preseason and you shut out every team. You could still go 0-16. And by the way, I think that happened with the Lions.
I was going to ask you, didn't they do that wonderful
juxtaposition? Yeah, I think they had a perfect preseason and then went 0-16. So I've seen it all. And preseason football is meaningless, but it does give you a glimpse at players. And Baker Mayfield and Saquon Barkley, who sat atop the board when the draft was breathlessly held earlier this spring, did have their flashes of, well, I guess that's why we drafted these guys. Mm-hmm. And, you know, although Baker Mayfield is still not scheduled to start, I mean, they've got you remember when Ty Taylor was the young talent just a blink ago, and now he's just a place setter for Baker Mayfield until he's ready. Saquon Barkley reminded me of Barry Sanders. When Barry Sanders held out in his rookie year, he didn't really play the preseason, and he signed so late that, you know, he only got into – he didn't play any preseason games. They handed him the ball on his first run, and he did some juke move and left some guy in the dust, and everyone said, this guy's going to be fantastic. He then had a lot of one-yard runs, and that's also what happened with Saquon Barkley with a 39-yard tear-off on his very first handoff in football, and then three more attempts that netted him, I think, 3 or 4 yards.
Yeah.
But I guess what I'd like to ask about these two guys, and I think both of them are going to be stars in the NFL eventually. I think that Baker Mayfield's going to have a harder task of it because he's playing on a lousy team. And Saquon Barkley, the running back position, you know, you can show how great you are and even in losing efforts. Whereas it's rare that quarterbacks can show how great they are in losing efforts, because sooner or later it becomes their fault that they lost. They get an interception, they don't convert third downs or whatever. Let's share some first impressions of these two guys.
All right. Oh. Here's what I think. I think this will go down in football history as being one of the great quarterback classes. I really do. I'm not saying it's going to be the, you know, the one that had Dan Marino in it. And what was that? 83, whatever that year was. Yeah. But I honestly believe that there are as many as four or five future stars of this league that came out of this draft. And guys, you've heard me talk about this before. Here's the bet the Giants have made on Saquon Barkley, who did it in one run last night, excited the fan base, reminded you of everything he always did on all those Saturdays at Penn State. They are making a bet that they have a 37-year-old quarterback whose game can be propped up by the presence of Odell Beckham and Saquon Barkley to the point where Eli Manning could win one more Super Bowl for the Giants before he turns 40 or however long he's going to play. That's a pretty big bet, because I was thinking last night that Saquon Barkley, nor Odell, nor Eli can play defense for the New York Giants, a defense, even though it's the first preseason game, that allowed one of those quarterbacks to throw for more than 200 yards last night, meaning Baker Mayfield.
In his first game.
The Barkley thing is you know, when you read the New York papers, which I do every day, and the coverage of him is extraordinary, to say the least, and talk about the phenomenal.
One run, Bob. One
the
run.
Size
he's on.
Of the
he's on
thighs,
his way to Canton.
The quads, the thighs. He is. He's being set up. You know, he's a lot's going to be expected, but he is. I think he has a chance to be very special, and he is a home run hitter. There's no question. That run is a foreshadowing. There'll be several of those. But he does have a strange track record, even at Penn State, he had 39 yards and one carry and four in the next four. Now, is that his fault or the line's fault? I don't know. But the thing is that 39-yard run was an eye-opener, and that's what they're looking for.
Someone who spent many years watching arguably the greatest running back of certainly his generation, Barry Sanders. And it was such an education in how a team can get seduced into relying on a running back and what it does to your offense. I can tell you that the Giants need to beware. They need to beware if they think that Saquon Barkley is going to save their team. Now, I don't care what the newspapers are writing and what the fans are saying and all the rest of it. That's just how we're a highlight society, and we love highlights, and he's going to give a lot of highlights. But what happens when you start to rely on a running back is the defenses adjust, and it's very quick for them to start shadowing a running back or knowing where he's going. And what happens to the offense is it starts to sputter, because you get these one-yard runs that give you no – it's not just that you only gained 1 yard. It's that it kills all your momentum. I've watched year after year when the Lions would try to rely on Barry Sanders to basically win the game for them, that 1 yard, negative one, 1 yard, negative one, 47. 1 yard, negative one, 24. And it gets no rhythm to the receivers, no rhythm to the quarterback. Take a look at – I'm looking at it right now – the rushing leaders for last year in the NFL. If I asked you who led the league, would you know right off the bat?
No.
Kareem Hunt with Kansas City. Wonderful highlight stuff. We talked about him on the podcast. 1,327 yards. Didn't lead Kansas City to any greatness, right? Todd Gurley, second with 1,300 yards for the Rams. Okay, now granted, you know, they were a coming team, and he was a huge part of it. Le'Veon Bell is really the only guy in the top five who basically you can say, well, you can watch the offense moving down the field on account of him, but he's a different kind of runner. LeSean McCoy from Buffalo was fourth, and Mark Ingram from New Orleans. New Orleans had a great rushing attack, was fifth. So the question, I guess, that I'm asking, and it's interesting to watch in the NFL, is what end does a running back serve your offense? And I think Barkley's best chance is, Mike, is what you said. If there's a resurgent Eli Manning who's hitting accurate passes, and we haven't seen that in a while, and a resurgent Odell Beckham who stays healthy, and Barkley is the alternative attack that you hit when they're looking for the pass or they're worrying about Eli, not when they're all just sitting there saying, okay, come at us. We've got 11 guys to try to stop you.
Mitch, we've how many times have we had this, just since the draft, had the conversation based on what you just said? And Bobby, I'll ask you this too. Go back across the last, 20 or 25 years in the National Football League. When was a running back the difference maker on the team that won the Super Bowl? The last one I remember is when the Broncos beat the Packers in the Super Bowl, and Terrell Davis had that unbelievable game and dragged John Elway across the finish line.
Well,
It
was the extra ingredient.
Emmitt was a huge part of those teams. I get that. But I will ask this question again. When was the last time even a transformative running back like we think Saquon Barkley can be was the difference maker on the team that ended up getting the Lombardi Trophy?
I can't answer that because I think your premise is sound. But the thing about this one here is simply this, that the Giants are counting on the fact that they do have Beckham, they do have Shepard, they do have Ingram, who is a very good pass-catching young tight end. And now they can augment that with the presence of a powerful running back a home run threat, that they're going to have a balanced offense now in that regard. I mean, it's not as if it's all about him. It's about that he is a new ingredient in the whole. And not to mention the fact that he's going to be expected to catch passes out of the backfield himself. So it's not just a matter of it's all about him. It's a matter of he's a new addition to what they thought was a very potentially powerful.
Yes and no, because Mike was right with this. You know, they passed a quarterback up to get him. It's not just about this year. It's about what they could have had this year. They're not necessarily. What was their pick, Mike? Were they second?
Second.
Two.
No.
Okay.
Two.
You're not going to get
that
every year.
They took him ahead of Sam Darnold.
Right.
They
but you're not going to get. In other words, Bob, what I'm saying is, it's not like okay, this year when we finish with a record that gives us a second pick in the draft, then maybe we'll take a quarterback. You only get so many cracks at this. So it's not like they just picked him to compliment. They picked him instead of. Hmm. He is always going to be, as Mike pointed out, the guy we picked instead of. Okay. And if he just becomes an element of an offense, and then Eli Manning is out of there and they're searching for a quarterback, trying to draft at 17 or 18 every year, it's going to magnify even more that he was instead of. By the way, pulled up a list of the best performances in the Super Bowl by running backs. Every one of them is like when we were kids. Timmy Smith with Washington Redskins, Marcus Allen with the Raiders, Terrell Davis with the Broncos, Emmitt Smith with the Cowboys, Roger Craig with the 49ers, Ricky Waters with the 49ers, John Riggins with the Redskins, Larry Zonka with the Miami Dolphins. That's your top eight. None of them are current. None of us are of this era.
Right.
So we've seen how the game has, and you know, talk about Philadelphia winning. I mean, they basically, the rushing was, you know, having LeGarrette Blount on their team, but they really, nobody is relying on a running back to lead you to the promised land all the way. That's what you can draw from this.
Mitch and Bob, remember what the storyline was across the last regular season. Oh my God, Eli is old now. They are bad enough that they're going to get to draft a quarterback again, the way they got bad enough to draft where they drafted in the year where they traded up and ended up with Eli Manning. That was the narrative in a quarterback-rich draft. And Dave Gettleman, the new general manager, who's a respected guy, he didn't love any of the quarterbacks enough to blind him on his love for Saquon Barkley. Mitch, this clearly, if you listen to Gettleman talk, Saquon Barkley had him at hello, okay? And it was like all those other quarterbacks and all the workouts and all the draft day stuff, they were going to have to do something to move him off that position. They never did. But you guys, I'm going to sound like a broken record for as long as we do this, okay? Barkley may turn out to be great in the National Football League, but if Sam Darnold is a 10-year quarterback in their building for the New York Jets, they were wrong not to take him.
They better hope that Baker Mayfield turns out to be the best quarterback of that whole class, because that way they can say, well, we didn't have a chance at him. It wasn't our fault. Cleveland already took him. I also want to bring up, before we move finally to the new NCAA rules in basketball, so this was really the first, you know, spate of games that we had, and there were dotted protests of the anthem. A couple of players in Miami, a player here or there on other teams, stayed in the locker room, and as predicted, The NFL doesn't know what it's doing. They have no idea how to handle this. The players said, well, you're not going to take away, I'm generalizing here, you're not going to take away my right to protest. One said, I'm a black man in America. I have an obligation to stand up for things that we've heard before. And the NFL issued a statement saying, our policy continues to be our policy. We expect players to stand or be in the locker room. The end. No punishment, no anything, because there is no policy, and they're not going to be able to agree on this, and they're not going to get 100% following no matter what they come up with, and then they're going to be faced with the issue. So what do we do with this guy? And if they really do come up with some kind of harsh policy that they agree upon with the players union, and then someone violates it, that person is going to be the sacrificial lamb. That person's going to be the martyr. That person's going to be this year's version of Colin Kaepernick if they suddenly are suspended for two games or something like that. It's just a no-win situation, and we're already beginning to see it in a preseason game.
Here's what our president, he's on this again this morning because he thinks he can make political hay with it. NFL players are at it again. This is a tweet. Taking a knee when they should be standing proudly for the anthem. And you know this, guys, because by God, this president put his life on the line. Oh, no, wait, that was other presidents. Numerous players from different teams wanted to show their, quote, outrage at something that most of them are unable to define. And guys, he's back at this again, and in subtle and not so subtle ways, saying that these guys don't know what they're doing, that they're dumb.
And that's going to only exacerbate it, because that's I felt towards the end of last year, that's what it basically became about. It was about Trump. And it was about the Trump administration, and it was about we don't like him in the White House, and we are protesting everything under his administration. And instead of it being about police brutality, which is where it began with Colin Kaepernick, it just became about being black in America, or being black in America under Trump. And considering he's, you know, scheduled to be president, I say scheduled to be president for another 2 years. Yeah. You know, every time he puts a tweet out, it might as well be gasoline on your barbecue.
That's if more than anything fit it else. Around his golf dates.
Yeah, by the way, guys, I'll ask you this again. Is a couple of players doing this some sort of sign of the apocalypse? Does a couple of players, if a couple of players do it every week, is the level of outrage going to be turned up again? You have heard me say this before, and I do understand both sides of this debate. Okay. I am the son of a 94-year-old war hero father. Okay. And I talk about this with him all the time. Does my dad wish they would stand? Yes, he does. But as he said to me many times, Mitch and Bob, when I was flying around in B-24s over Europe in 1944, I didn't cherry pick which rights I thought I was fighting for. I was fighting for all of them. And the fact is, and you've heard me say this before, dissent is as patriotic as the song, as the flag, as anything.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and I just keep coming back to the idea that this thing was tamping down until Donald Trump injected himself in it on that fateful Friday in Alabama last year. And he is not, obviously, he is not going to let this go, Mike, as you pointed out, It is a key talking point for him with his vaunted base. And that's that. But Mitch, it's hilarious. You're right. The league is just befuddled. To say the least.
I've got a suggestion, Mitch and Bob. Okay, he says the players don't understand him. Let's make this a pay-per-view event. Okay, and we'll just pick one player because I think he's been as eloquent as anybody on this subject. Malcolm Jenkins. Okay, him and the president one-on-one. Having a debate, wouldn't you pay what you pay for Mayweather Pacquiao to see that, and then see which one of them understands the issues better? I'd pay for that.
In the realm of mass confusion, it's a cousin to the confusion of how you set a policy for anthem standing, is how you treat college basketball players. And if they want to go pro or not. I mean, if you want to talk about organizations that are just befuddled, you can talk about the NFL owners on the anthem, and you can talk about the NCAA, who is as the years go by and maybe you guys find this as you get older covering sports too. My, if I had any respect for the NCAA when I began, and I think all young sports writers, you know, it's a massive organization and you're starting out and you're going to the first Final Fours you've ever gone to and you say, wow, I have so little regard for the NCAA, and to me, they're like F Troop. You know, it's just watching them constantly stumble over one another while still supposedly holding some positions of power. And this latest attempt to make a policy to deal with the greed and corruption that goes on in college sports, their answer is to come up with this half-baked policy of allowing some group. First, they say USA Basketball, and USA Basketball says, we don't want it. Make the NBA do it, to identify the real prospects who are going to possibly make the NBA and let them get agents and let them explore the world, have a separate set of rules for them that's different from the kid who might come out of nowhere. By the way, is obviously going to be different than from a foreign player and all the rest of it. It seems like they honestly, they threw some flour and some water and some sugar, mixed it around, threw it in the oven for 3 minutes and took it out and said, here's our policy. And I don't know if you're as confused as I am by what this is going to be, but this certainly to me didn't answer any questions about what's going to happen to college basketball players or how it's going to clean up the game.
And I just loved reading the stories, Mitch and Bob, and I know you guys too, that the NCAA commissioned some committees and some subcommittees, Mitch, some subcommittees to look into this issue. But who does this help? How many, Bobby, how many players do these new rules, how many undrafted guys, didn't they say like this would have affected like six kids in the draft? Who is this helping?
Yeah, a very small number. Last year, I'm quoting from the today's Boston Globe, Gary Washburn. Last year, there were 30 early entry players from Division I schools who went undrafted. Okay, 30. So start with that. Now, some of them, and he cites two examples, Tyler Davis at Texas A&M and Trevon Duval at Duke, were categorically stated they weren't going back to school anyway. So, you know, if they didn't get drafted, well, they'll worry about it. But anyway, can we just get right to the, you know, to the chase? The whole thing is this: the NCAA, that the world of college basketball and college football that most of the three of us really grew up in. I'm older than both of you, but so I go back and really say the 50s is no longer, doesn't exist, and the reason it doesn't exist is money, money. The money that is now is the driving force for everything is money, and protecting and follow the money is the thing, and that's that. And so they won't acknowledge that the whole model of, well, a scholarship is a wonderful thing. It's enough, and everybody should be thrilled with that, and all that, and everything's going to revolve around that. Is enough of a reward for these the thing for the athlete. When the coaches are making the money they're making, and when the schools are involved in these, the NCAA is involved in these contracts, and all this stuff's going. I mean, it's a joke. The protecting the amateur ideal is a nonsensical thought in 2018.
Mitch, off what you just said about the NCAA. I have a serious question. A, do you think there will even be a form of the NCAA in 10 years in college sports? Or do these continue to be the last days of the Roman Empire? And Mitch, how many times do we have this conversation when we were doing the television show, okay? At what point do all those super conferences get together, okay, come up with a new blueprint for college sports and look at the NCAA and say, tell me again what we really need you for?
Well, it's a really good question, Michael. And I would love to live in a world and live long enough to see a world that doesn't have the NCAA in it. But I think it's probably folly to think even in 10 years that it'll be gone completely, because it also enforces things like Title IX. And, you know, we talk about the NCAA a lot with is it determining whether a kid loses his scholarship over a hamburger that was bought by a booster, but it also enforces a thing that schools have grappled with, have gotten their arms around, and have to deal with. And it is sort of the presence. It's kind of the go between the torch runner between the federal government and sports programs at colleges. So Title IX, which protects everything from making sure that small programs and women's programs get the same as men's programs, all the way to what your rights are and your civil rights are on a college campus, somebody's going to have to enforce that. And if you don't have an NCAA, who's that going to be? So there probably needs to be some organization that is kind of a conduit between the federal government and college programs. But in terms of being practical and of any use, they passed their use-by label a long time ago. And what they're trying to do is just hang on to their own significance. And let's face it, with this legislation, to a certain degree, or this proposal, it's not legislation, to a certain degree, they're trying to protect, they're trying to keep their product alive. They're trying to keep that freshman who they would love to see come back for another year at UCLA or Kentucky or whatever, from disappearing altogether if he's not happy with his draft position and allowing him to come back into the game so that they can keep a star. So they're changing the rules, which I think should have been always in place, that if you test the waters and you go out there and you find out that you're not going to get drafted or you go undrafted, you can come back. And it allows kids to sort of say, like you and I could do right now, Mike, if we were starting college and on a music scholarship. All right. You're the guitar player and I'm the drummer. And we go to college and we're 1 year on a scholarship for music. And all of a sudden someone comes along and says, hey, you want to go on the road with us? And we say, yeah, that sounds pretty cool. And so in the summer, we go out on the road and we're thinking, we're not going back to college. We're on the road with this big band. And after a month or two, we go, you know, they're not paying us. It's not working out great. Let's go back to college. And we go. You can't do that if you're an athlete. As soon as you say, yeah, I'm going out on the road with the band, you're done. So they're trying to say, you know, let's create a path back. And I don't see any problem with that.
Yep, Mitch, it's a very good analogy. You're exactly right. And it just, but Mitch and Bob, isn't this just another reminder, even when they try to be well-intentioned, that this whole entity, especially in the realm of big-time college football and big-time college basketball, is simply ungovernable.
Yes, and I agree. And let me just throw out one more thought that in general terms, and Mitch, you're talking about the idea of the NCAA and the conduit between the government and everything. There's one other reason. Let's get back to the core reason why the NCAA exists, in my judgment. NCAA was formed circa 1910. And the basic reason that the NCAA exists is as a self-governing body of these institutions who got together is very simply this. No one trusted anybody. Right. No one trusted anybody no one trusts anybody now. They don't. If they don't have some kind of structure and rules, then they will be back to flat-out buying players, which they did in the 1890s, and they don't want that, in theory, even though, you know. So just remember that the NCAA, why it exists at all. And if you do a little study in the history, it's basically because nobody trusted anybody, and they had to have some rules to rein in the excesses that were existing in the 1890s in the early part of the 20th century. So this is who they are. We're talking now about human nature.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
All right, on that note, it is time for our parting shots, and Mike Lupica leads off.
Okay, sometimes you know with young quarterbacks, sometimes you don't. Everybody knew with John Elway and Peyton Manning, who ended up working together later in Denver and winning a Super Bowl together. Hardly anybody knew about Joe Montana coming out of Notre Dame. Everybody thought Ryan Leaf was going to be a lot more than a bust-out case, and we thought Robert Griffin III was going to be so much more than he became after he stopped being blessed with good health. We thought Andrew Luck was going to be Peyton in Indy. So I can't tell you that Lamar Jackson is going to be a star in Baltimore. But I think he's going to be one as much as I want him to be one. I think he's going to light it up for the Ravens eventually the way he did at Louisville when he became as exciting a Heisman Trophy quarterback as I have ever seen with my own eyes. I thought he was the most under-evaluated quarterback in a quarterback draft. I still think so. He threw for 119 yards against the Rams Thursday night, got sacked, looked like a rookie. But one who makes you want to watch him. And to paraphrase a famous old football writer named Dr. Seuss, makes you wonder about all the places this kid might go.
Oh, speaking of quarterbacks, everything about Tom Brady is, different than any other quarterback. For openers, he just turned 41. And then there's his contract, which was altered only yesterday. Did you know the man many think is the GOAT at what he does is only the 16th best paid quarterback in the NFL? Of course, he doesn't need the money since his wife makes even more than he does. But bravo for him, not wanting to keep score at the pay window as so many do in all sports. Now, here's what I don't understand. His new contract is incentive laden, potentially $5 million worth. Huh? This to me is an insult. Shouldn't you just pay a five-time Super Bowl winner, an eight-time Super Bowl participant, and reigning MVP a straight salary at age 41? Incentives are for peons, not demigods. Or what am I missing here?
Reportedly, some 11,000 people have signed a petition that LeBron James should replace Betsy DeVos as education secretary. While people are free to do what they want, if you have nothing else to do in your spare time but start one of these petitions or sign one, I know plenty of hospitals and soup kitchens that can use some volunteers. Now, I know some of this is just protest of the Trump administration, but the myopia that led fans to suggest LeBron, a high school graduate who skipped college, would be a great education secretary, was fed by the media's breathless attention to his opening a school in his hometown of Akron. This was met with countless news stories and all but 24-hour TV coverage, mostly because it was the first time LeBron would speak about his basketball move to L.A., saving his comments for an internal public relations moment, as athletes are now wont to do. Now, opening a school can be a noble thing, but for those with money, it's not exactly unique. Oprah did it. Jalen Rose did it. Shakira did it. Pitbull did it. Tony Bennett, Angelina Jolie, Magic Johnson, Serena Williams, even Will Smith and Jada Pinkett Smith have all opened schools, even though Will and Jada homeschooled their own kids. Perhaps not surprisingly, their school closed after 5 years. The point is, it's not the first time this has happened, and I'm pretty sure no one thinks that Will and Jada Smith should be running the Department of Education. LeBron deserves kudos for trying to make a difference. Absolutely. 11,000 names on a petition just shows how misdirected people's frustrations are getting. That's going to wrap it up for this edition of the Sports Reporters Podcast. We do this every Monday and Friday, so we'll be back on Monday with a lot to talk about, I'm sure, about the PGA, the last PGA in August, and other preseason NFL and baseball news as well. If you like what you heard, leave us a comment. If you didn't like what you heard, leave us a comment. We enjoy hearing from you either way. And you can tell your friends they can get this podcast, which is the continuation of the TV show that we did for so many years on ESPN. They can get it anywhere they get popular podcasts these days. Until we see you on Monday, on behalf of Mike Lupica and Bob Ryan, this is Mitch Albom saying, have a great weekend.